Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 169 for June 8th, 2011. Jenkins. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed to your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. Plus, get DVDs by mail in about one business day. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey everyone, welcome to Floss Weekly. This week I am back again. I have gotten slightly over my really bad cold that I had last week. I really appreciate Dan Lynch stepping in and taking the primary chair there for the last week's show. I was just coughing so continuously. I'm hoping not to cough too much today. I've got my hand right over the mute switch just in case something goes wrong. I'm back. Yeah, I'm back in the big chair. This really works. But of course, I'm not alone. I'm not alone this week at all. I am here again with Simon Phipps. Simon Phipps, welcome as the co-host again.
Why, thank you very much, Randall. It's good to see you not on a cruise. It seems wrong somehow for you not to be on a cruise.
It is unusual for me to not be on a cruise. However, I'm in the room that looks like the kitchen at the Media Temple again today. I was supposed to be in the other room, and there's somebody sleeping in it. So I thought I should probably not be waking them up just so I can do a show. But thanks again to Media Temple for the place to actually do this show from and for the great bandwidth so I can actually get that done. We have a really great guest on today. Oh, Simon, I'm not supposed to mention that you're a bit older today, right? I'm not supposed to talk about on the show?
Let me just hide up the badge so that no one finds out anything at all about it. There we go. Because okay. There is no sense in which I'm any older. I'm 32. That is hex, but hey, you have to live with these things.
I know. Anyway, so we have a really great guest on today, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name, but let me try anyway. It's Kosuke Kawaguchi is how I've been saying it. It's probably totally wrong. We'll have to ask him how it actually gets pronounced. Actually, I understand his friends actually just call him KK. So we're bringing KK on today to talk about the project that used to be called Hudson when he started it, and now is called Jenkins. It's a continuous integration server. What that means is that as you're checking your code into your repository, this thing notices that and checks it out and then runs all of your tests for you and then also packages it up for the various packaging systems and does a whole lot more. We'll have to get into all the details about how that all works. But I know this thing is being used industrially all over the place. It's being used here at Media Temple. It's being used for the Squeak team, all sorts of places like that. What's your familiarity? You know KK, don't you?
I used to work with KK at Sun Microsystems. It was he was working there when he started the Hudson project, and I made sure that Sun had policies that let him do all sorts of cool stuff without too much management interference. And now today at ForgeRock, the company that I'm helping found, we're using Jenkins for continuous integration ourselves. So I've kept up that contact with him over the last several years.
Great, great. And although we're distant right now, I want to say you and I are both going to be somewhere together in a few weeks, right?
I'd heard that rumor. I had heard that it would be essential for us to drink some caipirinhas together and possibly eat some barbecue at Charas Correa. But we can only do that, Randall, if you're able to say Charas Correa and caipirinha. Otherwise, you're just going to have to watch.
Charas Correa and caipirinha, is that close enough?
we're going to wear this. So that's at Fisle 2011, which is down in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil. It's one of the world's largest free software conferences. FOSDEM and linux.conf.au are the other two really big ones. Mm-hmm. And I've been invited to go down there and give a talk, just as I believe you have, Randall.
Yes, I'm one of the keynote speakers as well. I'm actually the very last one listed on the page. I don't know why they put me at the very last, even when they put other people ahead of me. So it's not alphabetical. I know that's not the reason. But anyway, I'm going to be talking actually about lessons learned from Flossing Weekly. I'm actually going to take extracts of these shows and, you know, abstract it down and tell people what we're learning from talking to all these really great people we get to talk to. And also by talk about sort of the technology behind the show. How do we do this and why do we do it? And you know, what's involved actually going behind the scenes. And so it should be a fun little talk. talk to give. So I'm really looking forward to that. Before we bring on our guest, before we keep chatting about things that are not relevant to the guest or anything else, I want to say we have a sponsor. I love this sponsor, Netflix. I love Netflix. I've been a Netflix subscriber for a while now. And let's see where my ad copy is that I have to actually read here. It says Netflix delivers movies directly to your home, and that saves you time, money, and hassle. You can instantly watch thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed directly to your PC or Mac. That's how I watch it most of the time. Or stream to your TV via Netflix-ready device, such as the Xbox 360, the PS3, the Nintendo Wii. I have a Roku. It works on my Roku. I also have an iPhone. It goes directly to my iPhone while I'm, you know, in public transportation. I can actually watch television shows and movies and stuff like that. You can also get DVDs by mail in about one business day, I'm told. I don't actually get the DVDs, but I hear it's a really good service. You can watch as many movies as you want, anytime you want. There are never any late fees or due dates. So I watch a lot of stuff on Netflix. I just wanted to say that if you're a Summer Glau fan like I am, this, three of her most recent series are actually on Netflix. All of the Terminator series she was just in, the Dollhouse series, she was in the second season there, so all of Dollhouse is on available to watch on Netflix streaming. Serenity, the original series, that cult following, the entire series is also available there, as is the Serenity movie. So you can watch the movie, you can also watch the entire series directly on Netflix. It keeps me busy. I have about 230 episodes of shows that I put in my Netflix queue just so I can watch. So I can be watching TV every night for years to come without having to worry about what to select. There's just so many things on there. We just want to say that you can instantly watch any of the things I just talked about or choose from thousands of other TV episodes or other movies when you register for a free trial membership. You go to netflix.com/twit and you get a free 30-day trial. Be sure to sign up now. And we thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Floss Weekly. So anything to say before we bring on our guests, Sam?
I'm just saying how much I'm looking forward to talking to KK and how much I would love to see any listeners down in Brazil to join me for a caipirinha and to test whether you can say Charles Correa.
That sounds like a great thing. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest. And I'm sorry, I've been mispronouncing your name for almost 3 months now, but it's Kosuke. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nowadays, because it's so hard to pronounce, I'm being called as KK.
Just KK?
Yeah.
We'll use that for the rest of the show then. But can you pronounce your name accurately for me once so I can actually hear what it sounds like?
That's Kosuke.
Oh. Okay, well, I really had it wrong then, that's for sure.
That's all right.
And I think I did an okay job introducing Jenkins, formerly called Hudson, at the beginning of the show. But let's go ahead and hear your 30-second overview of what this whole project is about.
Okay, so it's primarily a CI server, the continuous integration server. And so what it does, well, it can actually do a lot of things from, but the most of the time people use it to automate the build and test execution on the servers. And then from there, you can build up more interesting automation flow, like things like continuous delivery and so on. So that's mainly what it does.
Okay, and how would people be using this?
It actually gets like two ways of getting introduced to the workplace. And sometimes there are like very motivated member of the team who enjoy doing the software development the right way, quote unquote, the right way. And then these guys start putting Jenkins on their machine. And then their colleagues should notice that and they like it. And then it's gradually spread from there. So that's like a bottom-up approach in getting things spread. And some other cases, the managers decide that it's a good idea to get a CI practice introduced. And then so they go all that and buy a bunch of servers and then put them in there. And then people will be forced to use it, but hopefully they like it. And then that's how it goes. So regardless of how you start it, it's the server application. So it's a web application that you interact with. HTTP from the browser, normally it sits in one of your server rooms or the labs, and then you can just configure everything from the web, and then you can get the builds and tests executed on one of your server machines. So I guess that's how people use it normally.
Interesting.
Okay, so KK, just to sum up, the idea of the Jenkins is it means you never have to run a build again. Every time you make a change, magically it's already there built. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think that's the holy grail. that is, you know, we want the goal in this project is that so the people, the developers, should be just keep on making changes and committing, and then move on to the next thing as soon as he's done with something. And then you let the Jenkins do the build and test to make sure that your changes are okay, and then push them up to the team repository so that your colleagues should see it. It will take care of the merging and stuff like that for you. So that's the holy grail. It's not quite. I think the most of the users typically aren't there yet. So they still prefer to make sure that the things are reasonably okay before committing changes to the repository. So the people will be still running build and test locally before they commit. And then they use the Jenkins to sort of create the visibility into the project by having this central server monitoring the test execution status and so on. And occasionally, obviously, people forget to commit or people forget to run tests and so on, so that the Jenkins will be able to catch them. And then beyond that, I think beyond the build and test, most of the time, the real value in Jenkins, in my mind, comes from building more complex automation around it. So once you're done with testing, maybe you'd hand it over to the testing team, and then that would do more expensive tests, right? So you could automate those flows entirely inside Jenkins. And then, so that part would really save the effort from humans. The things that more or less happen automatically, and you get the result at the end. So that I see is where it's going.
Right. Now, as I recall from the old days, this started out as a Java tool.
Yes.
But today, I believe that Jenkins has got a wide range of different capabilities. Do you want to just give us an impression of what the scope of those capabilities is?
Yeah, so in some other languages, I guess part of it is that in many Java shops, they do other languages as well. Like, you know, a lot of companies do both Java and .NET. And so once they learned about Jenkins, they naturally wanted to use it for those other projects. So people develop plugins to integrate with those tools. So you have very good .NET integration. And then there are languages who just don't. So naturally, I guess the developers want to use a tool that's written in the same language that they are developing. So the Ruby developers would prefer to use tools written in Ruby. Python developers would prefer to use tools written in Python. But there are some languages who don't have a viable CI server written in that specific language. And C++ being one, I think the Python would be another. So in those language communities, they really embrace Jenkins very much. And that's also true, I think, recently in Ruby, even though Ruby has a lot of CI servers. So we have a number of plugins. Unfortunately, I'm not a real expert in Ruby or Python, but you can see a number of test framework integrations, the build tool integrations, and so on. So I think it's a really convincing option, even if you're developing in languages other than Java. Sometimes they have some, I guess, the reluctance to use tools in Java, right? Because the Java is, I guess, the 21st century of COBOL. But I think it's okay. Like someone did a presentation in Python. It's okay to use Jenkins. You don't need to notice that it's written in Java.
Right. So how does this work in your community? Because you must have lots of people with different expertise in different programming languages. What sort of a community have you got there that's building all this software? Is it diverse? How's it structured?
Right. So I think the part of the key, initially it was my experiment in sort of like a new, the social structure in the project that I thought really worked well was sort of confine people into plugins. I guess the geeks don't, well, so the geeks don't enjoy communicating with each other in a way. Or when you have to communicate over the code, it slows things down. It's a lot easier when you could just let people do whatever they want to do and then let them do so in a way that doesn't interfere with what you're trying to do. So this plugin mechanism, which is, I think, the very extent, very unique, I should say. The degree of extensibility we got in Jenkins is pretty unique, and then that enabled us to, you know, everyone to essentially own his own little piece of land and then do whatever they want to do with it. And, you know, sometimes people come up with very useful ideas, sometimes they come up with crappy ideas, but when they do come up with the useful ideas, the community as a whole would benefit. And so in the Jenkins project, we got the interesting committer policy going that the if you just ask us to host a plugin with us, we'll give you the commit access right away. We don't try to require that you prove yourself before we give yourself a committership, unlike many other open source projects. So a lot of people, I mean, random nobody from our perspective, you know, people who we never heard of just show up in the mailing list and they want to become a committer because they developed the plugin XYZ. And so we get a constant inbound flow of people like that. And then the things that happen, the other thing that happens in the open source project is that people tend to move on. You know, they just scratch their own niche. And then once they are done with it, then they just go on to do the next thing for them. And so when that happens, if the plugin is hosted inside the Jenkins project, you know, we are still left with that plugin source code. And then by allowing random people to become a committer, it also allows us to find a new maintainer for existing plugins, and so they can pick up where the original guy has left off, and then they can carry it on. So that allows us to create like a long-term maintainability of the plugins, even though people working on it has changed over time. So, right. So that, I think that structure is still somewhat unique. That I think the committership is often still regarded as something sacred that you don't want to hand out too quickly, but we sort of changed that drastically in Jenkins, and it seems to be working.
Right, right. So has it caused you any problems at any point? Have you had anyone show up who's turned out to be a problem, or has it that all gone perfectly for you, that openness?
Yeah, so I'd imagine the Wikipedia, I guess this is really close to the Wikipedia model that, you know, the people initially get surprised that, oh, but, you know, don't you get some problematic people? But it turns out that they don't, I guess, you know, I can't recall any incidents. So the only thing that I remember happening is, well, someone made like a wrong subordinate operation and then ended up deleting the whole tree. So that had to be reported. But I guess that's the beauty of having version control system, right? Like just because you're a committer doesn't mean you get a final say. So if someone did something that, I guess, you know, the honest mistake or something else, it could always be reported. So that happened once. In another incident, I think there was a localization contributor wanted to, I guess, see his change, and then they released a few plugins, and so that was noticed, but it didn't really result in any major incidents. So I think overall, I think it was a very good choice for us.
Right. So now this whole deal was your private project while you were working at Sun Microsystems. How did that work out for you? How did it end up being something that was happening at work as well as at home?
So the original motivation for this project was, well, you know, partly work-driven. That is, you know, I used to work for the groups at that Java EE, but I noticed one day that I'd never written any Java EE app, and then thought that there was something basically wrong with like me producing code that I don't ever use. So I wanted to fix that by writing some program. It's also partly because I used to be a guy who forget the commit files. So I needed some program like Jenkins so that I don't embarrass myself too often. So I started writing this software, but I was, you know, deploying it for my company project. And so my colleagues started finding out and they find it useful. And then my neighboring team started discovering that our team is using this little tool called Hudson back then. And so it gradually spread inside the company. I guess the other interesting thing about open source is that even it's often the best way to communicate inside a company is to do the open source project, because there's really no viable internal communication channel. So some of the other teams inside the Sun discovered the tool and then they started using it. So I guess that's eventually the adoption grows from there, and then eventually I find out that, you know, I really need to be spending some time to keep my colleagues productive by fixing issues and maintaining the deployment. So that's when it sort of switched into my day job. So it's interesting. But yeah, I guess one kudo that I need to give to Sun was it was very open to letting employees work on these kind of open source projects. You know, so I didn't need to have to ask for the permissions or anything like that. So for that, I'm very grateful.
Yes, that was indeed the policy that we put in place there. So tell me, since then, back in those days, it was called Hudson.
Right.
And I don't know whether you want to explain to our audience why it was called Hudson, and because I think that understanding that will help them understand why it's now called Jenkins.
So in Sun, we had this group of people called release engineers whose job is to, you know, do the builds and keep the archives and otherwise create the official builds. And so I was originally naming this software as my, you know, the release engineer of our team, because I guess in my mind this tool was to do what she was doing. But I mean, clearly that wasn't a very friendly thing to do in the workspace. If you try to write a program that depreciates a person, that's just not, you know, not a very nice thing. So before I started actually using it, I had to rename it to something else. But by then, I really liked this idea of giving this program a human name, you know, so that you could say, well, let's have Hudson do this, or you know, did Hudson already run the test and things like that. And then I really started thinking it as another person in the team. And then that fit well with the vision that I had with the tool. And so, you know, I thought, well, what's the kind of people, what kind of human name should I give it to it? I mean, should I give to it? And then the butler sounded like a kind of person who would serve other people. So I thought the butler would be a good theme. And then, you know, I thought about a few names. The Jeeves, the obvious one, was taken. And then so I just randomly decided that the Hudson kind of sounded like a British butler. I guess that's me being a non-native speaker. So that's how it became Hudson. And then only later I discovered, like, asking the British guy that it doesn't really make particular sense to them. But I guess that was too late by then.
It made perfect sense to me when I saw it, I have to say.
Thank you.
Oh, there's no problem. Then something happened. There was a change, and you were no longer working for Sun, and
right.
the project changed its name. Why did the project change its name?
Right. So even after it became my day job at Sun, it was a very interesting. It's a somewhat unique project in the sense that I was sort of really given more or less the complete freedom in choosing what to do. So the Sun essentially was sort of like a queen in UK, I'd imagine. It's a symbol. It's an overlord, nonetheless, but it didn't come down to the day-to-day operation of the project. And so, you know, we held Sun and put the proper due credit and so on. But otherwise, you know, the people involved in the community didn't really feel like it's a Sun project, at least in the same sense like the Solaris or NetBeans are Sun project. So when the Sun was bought by Oracle, there was the initial concern about, you know, whether something is going to change in the project, but it didn't. And then so the Oracle kept being this the indifferent overlord, and then that really worked well with us. But toward the end of the last year, I think around the October or November, we had this one incident in the outage of the project infrastructure. And then so that motivated us, I guess, finally to move the source code over to the GitHub, which was one of the recurring theme over the past at least 2 or 3 years. And so when we voted it among the developers and then started doing the migration, we heard from Oracle that, you know, we own the trademark on the name Hudson. And so you basically have to follow our way of running projects or highway. So, right. So that, I guess that was a very substantial and very much a shock for us, because, you know, that clearly signaled a change in the way the project is going to run. Right? It's no longer queen, but it's more like a prime minister who actually makes a call in those technical details of the project execution. So that didn't bode well with the people in the community, because the contribution from Oracle was very, very small, I mean, in terms of the code. So we tried to talk about so we started talking to them offline for the couple of months, tried to arrange a structure in which a trademark would be assigned to some neutral third party so that they don't have a veto power on things. Eventually it became very clear that that's not going to work out, that they are, you know, I think they, my understanding is that they are sort of, you know, they're playing a hardball, that they thought that the brand Hudson is valuable, that the developers would have to follow their ways. Eventually the people who were talking to Oracle after 2 or 3 months of negotiations decided that this is not going to work out. And we put forward a proposal to rename the project into Hudson, from Hudson into Jenkins, because in our mind, right, the people who are actually making the changes, you know, all happening outside Oracle, and then if it's just a name, then you know, it's not, well, it's a big deal in some sense, but it's not really a big deal in some sense. So that's how, and then that motion was approved by about the 214 versus 14, so it was almost unanimous of consent. They got a lot of support from in Twitter and other blog sphere. So that was this January, and then since then the project is now operating under the new name Jenkins. And then I guess the reason we chose Jenkins was again just that sounded like just another Butler name, and then. We also considered a few other names, but this one has domain name available and things like that. So it became Jenkins just like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And...
Hey, I'm back.
You are? I thought you were there. So I gather you're having some trouble with builders outside your window, Randall.
Yeah, just as we started this interview, I have to apologize to the audience. Just as we started this interview, a jackhammer started right outside the window, and you may still hear pieces of it. It's gone down about another 50 feet or I don't know if you can... Probably can't hear that. It's probably so quiet you can't hear it over there. But it was so loud that I couldn't even hear you guys talking. So if I ask a question that you've already asked, just stop me midstream, please. But I have a couple of questions now, having heard the last little bit of the show. How does this fit into a developer's cycle in terms of what continuous integration actually is? I mean, I see it from the perspective of both the Squeak project and here at Media Temple. We're using Hudson, Jenkins, whatever it's called. Uh-huh. Today, and what happens is that I check in something into SVN, and some sort of magical process behind the scenes then checks that back out and builds it. Actually, runs through the building and the testing, and then sends me an email report if I've broken something. This is where Jenkins fits in, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's in that sense, this kind of works somewhat asynchronously. So you know, you make a commit, and then you move on to work on something else. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, there's this server backend that's crunching numbers, doing the builds, running tests, and if something goes wrong, it's going to tell you. So if you don't hear anything back from Jenkins, then you're good to go. And then so you just even forget that there's something like this exists, and you go work on these other things. And then if you hear back from it, let's say within 30 minutes to an hour, it depends on how long it takes to run your build and test. And then you have to come back to your, you know, whatever changes that you worked on an hour ago and then make some follow-up fix. So in that sense, in that level, when you're using it like that, it's kind of like, in my mind, it's a bit like a seatbelt in your car. Mm-hmm. You know, you tend to forget that it exists, but it's helping you, like, it's helping you take a bit bigger risk, if you may. Mm-hmm. Or when something bad happens, I mean, you are exposed to less problems or less damages. So in terms of like how it fits into the developer's workflow, it removes some of the risks that you have, and then that allows you to be less careful, and then that or to put in more positive term, it allows you to be a bit more agile. But then that's only the beginning in my mind. So like once you start automating a bigger flow, so the other aspect that this really automates well is sort of intra team collaboration. So it used to be where I work, there was this separate testing team, and then so the developers often have to interact with the test team to mm-hmm. hand over the binary that's supposed to be tested, or when they discover issue, you know, they need to send us the email describing the failure. We'd look at them, we'd fix them, and then we write them back and look, we have a fix. Can you test it again? So there is some kind of the communication overhead between developers, and then so, but with Jenkins, you could. If you're running both the build and those QE testing on the same server, people don't have to do anything like that. There is no need to send out the binary in the attachment. You just it all happens automatically. And then so that allows you to waste, you know, to avoid wasting time in emails and communications. And so on. So that's another part how it fits in.
And I had some of the Squeak developers argue with me. Actually, the Squeak board we met a couple of days ago and talked about setting up our own Hudson server because the Faro team has one and we would like one we have control over. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, well, I run tests. I test my stuff before I publish it. So why do I need something out there that's also doing this as well? Because Squeak doesn't really need to get built. We mostly have it for the continuous integration aspect of testing it all. And I said, well, wait, there's the downstream project of Seaside. Are you going to run all the Seaside tests every time we change Squeak Core? And of course, they said, Oh, no, that's not my responsibility. I don't have to do that. And I said, well, yeah, but having a central integration server, the Seaside team can upload their Seaside tests. The Squeak Core team can upload their Squeak tests. And anybody else who's downstream that depends on Squeak Core can also upload their test to the server, and we would know instantly that something broke for somebody else, or at least they would know forward it onto us. And I consider that aspect of it to be almost essential to any large communication package, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So by making things easier, you can afford to do things that was previously too tedious. Like if you ask the upstream team to run all the tests of downstream guys. I mean, they're not going to do it. It's just too much wasted effort from their perspective. But with machines getting cheaper, Jenkins doesn't mind doing those grunt work, and then so you can let them do that. And then you discover issues early on, and the people would be happier that way.
So this aspect of running tests for everybody is definitely a big piece of it, at least as far as I can see and how it's being used in the places I see it. But I also understand that the other big aspect of this is that it's building packages, so binary packages. And apparently you have to build different kinds of packages for different versions of Linux and stuff. I'm not much of a Linux user, so I don't know about this, but there's different ways to install things under Linux. And so you might be running one kind of packaging system versus another kind of packaging system, and Jenkins would be building all these different versions from the sources.
Right, yeah, it's a very good point. So another thing that Jenkins is good at is taking care of the lots of computers. So especially when you have to build the installer for different platforms, then you need some coordinated activity across different machines so that you produce, let's say, the base bits, and then you have to package it up into different OS. And so you have to span across multiple machines and then get stuff executed and bring back the results. And those things you can very easily automate in Jenkins. So in fact, when we released the new version of Jenkins, we have to build the installer for Windows, the OS X, and various flavor of Linux, and then so we use the Jenkins to do those things. Without it, again, it's going to be a bit more tedious.
Now, Jenkins is integrated with things like Selenium, so you can do UI tests as well, right?
Right. So again, that's another place where this plugin ecosystem would really work well, because there are just way too many tools than any single person can keep track of. But we have some people writing Selenium plugins. We have some people writing a TestNG plugin, JUnit plugin, the PHP unit, and you name it. And we got those integration all taken care of, and then so you can really do a lot of interesting stuff. The web app testing is certainly very popular nowadays, and it works very well.
Now, how is Jenkins able to access OS X and Windows and things? Are you running virtual machines on the Jenkins server?
So a lot of people run those platforms in virtual machines just because it's nowadays it's easier to do so than having a physical machines. But from Jenkins' perspective, it doesn't really make a difference whether it's a physical machine or virtual machine. So what we do is we need to have a little program called slave agent inside this target machine that we want to control, and that maintains some kind of communication channel back with this master server. So this slave agent would act on behalf of the master to do certain operations like file access, launching processes, and so on. But from administrator's point of view, you're only going to interact with the master machine. We have a lot of nice integration to simplify the slave setup, so you don't have to go into the slave. If you have a SSH server running on the slave, the Jenkins has SSH client implementation in Java, so you can talk to this machine, and it can discover if Java isn't installed, it's going to install Java for you and copy the program and run the slave agent and start communicating it. So you really, it's very simple to set up. We have some people running around 200 slaves in a single cluster, so it's very easy to get a large cluster going.
So it sounds like you need to have a month or two just to play with it, just to get it to set up. Is it difficult to set up, or is it just something that pushed a couple of buttons and it's all working, or what, somewhere in between?
Yeah, so I think getting something simple up and running is very, very easy. So it can be actually installed through the Java Web Start, which means like you just have to come to our website and click a button, and then that will launch Jenkins on your own computer. And from there, you can configure everything in the UI. So let's say if you just want to get going with some simple build and test up on every commit, that can be done within 30 minutes to an hour maximum. And then as you gradually start liking it, you'd explore different aspects of it. So we see a lot of times we see the installation grow over the long time. You know, it's only at certain point you start realizing that you need more machines to keep up with the load. So all these distributed build stuff, you don't have to do it right at the beginning. You only need to work on it when you feel like you need to. So I wouldn't say it's going to be hard to install. Well, on the point of installation, the other thing, so we did spend a lot of effort making sure that at least getting up to speed is easy enough. So one of the things is we don't require that you run a separate database, because it tends to require some additional initial setup overhead to get the database connectivity going. So it's very easy that, you just have to click a button in our website, and that's all it takes to start using it.
Of course, I'm asking this with a personal intention, because I actually am the box administrator for the Squeak community, and I think I'm going to have to be setting up the Jenkins server for our continuous integration. That's why I'm... Now, what we'd be doing is we'd be having something triggered off of our change control system.
Yeah.
Would trigger something in Jenkins to go check out whatever the latest thing was. We'd have to provide some sort of command line tool, I guess, for that. But then once that happens, we just need to have it run our integration test. Wow, let's see. I wonder how that would come back to notify Jenkins that it worked or not. It's just integrating with our Squeak imaging system is what we have to figure out, right?
So the in terms of checking changes in the source code, the easiest thing that comes out of the box by default is like you let Jenkins pull the repository. So you say every 5 minutes, go check the repository to see if there was any changes, and then you don't have to really do any additional work. And then that's by far the easiest way to get going. Like I said, as the usage it grow, you start thinking, well, maybe the polling isn't the optimal approach. Like if you have, let's say, 300 different test execution going on the Jenkins server, and each one of them is checking the repository every 5 minutes, you start to think maybe there's a better way of doing it. And so at that point, you could switch to the push model, where you could have the repository telling Jenkins that, look, there is a change, go figure out what needs to be built. But that's another sort of like a gradual slope model that we define in Jenkins. You can start with something simple, and then if you decide later, you could do like better ways of doing it.
Okay, great. And you might have answered this already. Like I was not paying attention too well because of the stupid noise outside. Sure. But you're still the leader of the Jenkins project, and you still have people making daily commits to the Jenkins project. How many of those people were originally working on Hudson?
So let's see. So they, like I said, most of the people, often the plugin developers come in and move on. So but the original people working on the Hudson project, I think everyone except the guy from Oracle, I think he's now with Jenkins.
Okay, and. There was some talk recently of allowing Jenkins to use the name Hudson again. Is that moving forward, or did that get stopped somewhere?
I think you're probably referring to the Oracle the donating Hudson project into the Eclipse Foundation. Mm-hmm. So they are not letting the Jenkins project use the name. I think they are donating the trademark into the Eclipse Foundation and then running a project under there.
Well. So, How are the commits coming along on that project? I mean, are you swapping commits back and forth, or is it sort of just this rival thing out there now, or how do you deal with that?
Well, for my peace of mind, I haven't divorced myself, God forbid, not. But thinking back of what has happened, I think I'd imagine the divorce experience would be something like that.
It's a
very
maybe.
Very stressful several months about, what I'm going to do. Is there any way to fold things back? Like, did I do something wrong? And so on. But now that it's over, I kind of enjoy my single life again. And I try not to think about this other half. And then that works very well for me. So I don't look into changes that they're making, but sometimes people tell us that there is this thing that they fix it, so aren't you going to fix it in the Jenkins project? And I guess it appeals into our competitive nature, and so we nonetheless end up fixing the same issues. So I guess there's a certain degree of, the competition going on, but I don't think there's any serious changes. I mean, the changes flowing between two projects yet.
Now, who has the ownership, the copyright for the code in Jenkinson? Is it still a lot of Sun Oracle license issues?
Yes. So the copyright of the code is owned generally by people who wrote code. So for the portions that, so let's say if the people contributed patches, they are still owned by the people who made the patches.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the part of the code that I wrote on behalf of Sun/Oracle while it was my day job, it clearly belonged to them. And then there was also a substantial portion of the code which I wrote after I left Oracle, which clearly belongs to me, and so mm-hmm. on. But the copyright is, I guess, a hodgepodge of the mixture of the all kind of different, owned by all kind of different people on different portions. But the whole entire source code is licensed under MIT license, which is very liberal. Mm. So that in practical terms, it allows anyone to do pretty much anything with minimal legal overhead.
Now, who chose the MIT license? Because that would be unusual for something of this nature. More people would reach for the GPL right away.
Right. So I guess that's also, so I chose it because this started as my hobby project. And back then, I had my idol, shall I say, the guy named James Clark, who is to me is like a programmer god. And then he used to choose MIT for everything. And he mm-hmm. still might, I don't know. So I guess I thought, well, if my god is using MIT, it must be good for me as well. So I was just doing all my open source projects under MIT, so the Hudson was no exception. So I guess in that sense, it was a lucky choice. I mean, it was a lucky choice for me. If it was GPL, I think it might have some other implications.
And the code is mostly in Java, I understand?
Yes, pretty much all in Java and with some XML. We actually tried to change that. One of the relatively new efforts going on inside the Jenkins project is to enable plugins to develop entirely in Ruby. And then we'd be actually running it on JRuby, but the people writing plugins wouldn't really have to know that that's the case. And so that, I think, when that work is complete, we should have a good portion of plugins now written in Ruby, I think, which would be wonderful.
And like most open source projects, I'm sure you're looking for more people to contribute. Is there any particular yes. skills that people need to contribute, and any particular skills that you're lacking the most?
So I guess what people often don't seem to realize is that the writing code isn't the only way to contribute to the project. In fact, I think it's just one of many. So, like we have one of the very fortunate things that happened in the Jenkins project is we got this wonderful community guy named Tyler. And he has been very good at rallying the community and create the sense of unity in people. And that matters a lot. And then so that was invaluable. We have some other people who are writing books, which is another great, great contribution to the project. It's a lot of effort that not many people could actually take, but it's nonetheless, it takes the project into the next degree. So, if you can write Java code or know some XML stuff, then yes, wonderful that we'd be very much looking forward to having you, writing plugins and so on. But if you're just good at writing documentation, that's also great with us. And the other thing is that we really want people telling us where we have usability problems. I think watching people use Jenkins over their shoulders, one thing that I really cringe is that when tool doesn't behave the way it should, when it doesn't meet the expectation, not reporting errors in a nice way, or not providing early enough feedback about how they are doing something wrongly. Now, people often blame themselves for not doing things right, but we want more people blaming tools, saying, if I make a mistake, it's a tool's job to tell me that I made a mistake. And so I want more people reporting issues like that so that we could make the tool more usable for a larger number of people. And already right now, like I said, this... Uh, the um, the effort is going on to integrate, I mean, enable development in Ruby. And for that, we need, you know, we got some of the groundwork done to the point that we now need someone like really, some really Ruby guy that doesn't need anything about Java that tell us, look, this is how we do things in Ruby, that we expect, you know, we expect you guys to follow this convention and so on. So we're really looking forward to see some good Ruby developers willing to, you know, enable this great Ruby integration in Jenkins.
So, KK, I was interested to hear you saying there, to roll back a little way, about how Oracle had taken that copyright and donated it to Eclipse, completely ignoring the real community and encouraging Eclipse to go and pretend they were the community. And it was almost as if they wanted to kill you off. And I just noticed IBM and Oracle using exactly the same pattern with OpenOffice over the last week. I wonder if you have any useful advice or experience that you'd want to share with either the Apache or with the LibreOffice communities.
I'd actually rather love to hear their thoughts on this, but it's somewhat, I guess, I guess, yeah, so like it's like, well, I don't know how to phrase it nicely. we thought, so I guess in a way it's sort of, I think I was very proud of what the Jenkins community did, in the sense that our success at the Jenkins project, I think, made me force into this plan B, that clearly initially they weren't interested in giving up the control of the project to anyone else. So they thought they could run the project on their own. So I think in that sense, they are underestimating the value of the community that this project has developed around it. But after a few months, it became clear that they won't be able to sustain this by themselves. So I think it's great in the sense that we showed, I guess, we made a stand and then we proved ourselves that we could do what we said. So it's like a, I guess, we told you moment for us. So I think that it's the same with LibreOffice, that I think they are creating something very valuable, and then the Oracle had to recognize it. So I don't know, it was still unfortunate that they chose not to, to get things well reunited, or to acknowledge the fact that they didn't do the things the right way. But I guess such is the life. And like I said, for my peace of mind, I try not to think too much about what they should be doing, what they do. I'm primarily a guy who writes code, and I just enjoy things that way more.
Right. So it sounds like your advice would be to focus on the code, get on with being awesome, and leave the other guys to do their stuff if they think they can.
Yeah. I think the LibreOffice clearly got what's the great thing going on, and I think the Jenkins community also got the great thing going on, and then you just have to mind your own business. Our users are telling us what we need to do, and we have more than plenty on the plate just to work on those. So I think we just keep on keeping on, and I think the users understand that's where I think the user would eventually follow where the actions are. So and I'm comfortable so far that's happening in the Jenkins.
Well, sorry for putting you on the spot there for that question, but admirable response. I appreciate that very much. Just running out of time here, so I wanted to ask a couple more questions. And also, first wanted to ask you, the classic question, Emacs or VI?
I'm a VI guy, actually, but then I can't say that I'm using it the great way. I actually try to, every so often I feel like I need to learn Emacs, and I try it for a few hours, and I kind of stop. But I guess being Java developers, I think I consider myself more of a IDE guy. So I think unlike some other languages, we don't really use text editor like VI to edit code. So we like to think we are better than that. And then, so I don't know. So in that sense, I consider myself an IntelliJ guy.
Okay, great. And what your favorite scripting language? You're not using Java.
So that's another thing. I think I'm reasonably okay using Python. But every so often I feel like I now need to use Ruby. I try writing some scripts, and then I keep going back to Python for whatever reasons.
Well, Ruby's not bad as a prototype for Perl 6, so it's go ahead and learn Ruby, and then you'll be able to slide over to Perl 6 when it gets totally usable there. So, yeah, okay.
At least you didn't say small talk, Randall.
Yeah, I didn't. We're not pitching small talk just today. That's all. Well, great. Did we leave anything out? We've covered a lot of issues about Jenkins. Did anything else you want our audience to know?
I don't know. Let's see. Yeah. So if you aren't, I think a lot of people, the adoption of Jenkins has been really going up substantially over the past few years. And if you haven't had a chance to use it, I'd really love to have you try and let us know how it goes. Mm-hmm. And we are always interested in feedback, especially things that didn't work, you know, so that we can fix them.
Very good. Very good. Well, thanks for coming on the show today and putting up with my slight absence there and going through these difficult questions we asked you today. I thought we should have given you notes ahead of time. I know, but you covered it very well. So I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for having me and the opportunity. It's an honor.
Very good. Very good. So that was KK, we'll call him, working as the leader and original founder of the Jenkins Project, now called Jenkins Project. Very interesting. What do you think, Simon?
Well, I have to admit, you know, I've known KK for a while because we used to work together at Sun. I was always very impressed by the whole Hudson project and then by the way the community handled themselves when the transition over to Jenkins came. And we're using Jenkins at ForgeRock to do our continuous integration. I think that it's one of those quantum leaps in software engineering that happened when continuous integration servers came along. And I think that the future of software engineering is all going to revolve around that live compilation, live rendering, continuous integration of the code. Brilliant piece of software. I think it's a great effort. And I love the way that KK goes about it.
Well, it's absolutely also that it's proven itself industrially. I mean, that's the thing, too, is that, you know, it's used here at Media Temple and using it on the Squeak project. I remember a couple of the places before this, some previous clients were using it. And it's the kind of thing that you don't know you need until you need it. And then you really need it. And then you thought, well, how did I ever get along without having something like this? You know, you think, well, when I'm just a small team of developers, you know, I can check my stuff in and then turn around my back to the other cubicle and say, hey, just check in a fix for bug 37. You know, go test it with your code. But you know, when you're not in the same cubicle farm anymore, when you're working with a lot of downstream projects, it's invaluable to have something like this, especially, you know, not just the testing aspect, but as we also covered the packaging aspect of it, would kill this place here, I know, because you're doing new releases every couple of days and they have eight platforms they're supporting different flavors of Linux to do all the different kinds of servers they have here. You know, it would kill them to have somebody manually packaging this all up. So, you know, kudos to guys who can come up and see the vision for this kind of industrial strength, you know, let's fill this missing gap. No, that's backwards. Fill the need the gap fill. Whatever. Anyway, so it took care of it. That's what it did. It took care of it. That's the long way to say that. Right, Simon, right? And Simon is quiet. Oh, I guess I'm covering again. All right. Well, we'll be cool. I'll just want to do my awkward transition to the upcoming guests. Oh, man. Do I have a lot to talk about upcoming guests? I started doing my Q3 bookings last week. And some of you following the Twitter feed probably saw this, that I was booking like a whole bunch of people on Sunday and Monday. So we have coming up next week, though, someone who's been on the list for a little while now, Curtis Jewell, friend of mine, going to talk about Strawberry Perl. It's not just flavored. It's a kind of Perl that runs natively on the Windows platform. And not only that, but it includes the compiler and everything else that you need to be able to build stuff off the CPAN. So on one easy download, and all of a sudden you can be almost as productive on Windows as you can on Unix with Perl. So that's really cool. Get to talk to him next week. Bradley Kuhn has just been booked on there. He's head of the Software Freedom Conservancy, been a longtime supporter of open source software. I'm really happy to have him on the show. Just got added to the list, and a whole bunch of them. I'll run through them real quickly here. Neil Gompa is going to talk to us about Enano CMS, which is one more content management system. Paul Beckingham is going to talk to us about Task Warrior. Task Warrior is a to-do list. It's kind of a command line thing, really cool thing for that. So we'll see that coming in a few weeks. I hope Simon comes back I hope Simon's going to be at OSCON, because I hope to do a live OSCON show like we did last year. We found a couple of really good projects to interview live. Hopefully we'll be able to do that from OSCON. That'll be the show for that week. We've got Colin Percival now on the schedule. He's going to talk to us about FreeBSD on EC2. So on the Amazon platform, how he had to modify FreeBSD to make it work, because normally there's only Linux and Windows clients up there. He also has a project called TarSnap. He'll talk about how you use open source software to make like this backup system that he uses for a lot of people. Perry McDowell is going to join us to talk about Delta 3D, which is a full real-world simulation engine for visuals, good 3D visuals, and also all the physics involved with that. And people are building games, and it was built originally using government money, so therefore it's all free and open because it has to be. Chris Sherman, sorry, I'm mispronouncing his, is going to talk to us about Synergy. That's a really cool thing. In fact, I was just trying to get it set up yesterday. It allows your keyboard to control, or keyboard and mouse to go on multiple monitors and multiple systems that are sitting next to each other. So you can basically like control a Windows box over on the left and drag your mouse over to your Linux box and drag it over to an OS X box sitting on the right, all just by moving your mouse around and type on each one of those. Very cool. The Apache Traffic Server, we've got Brian Call and Leif Hedstrom talk to us about that, real high-performance proxy server. Adam Armstrong is going to talk to us about Observium, which is a network management system. Looks really cool. Tomas Moras is going to talk to us about LibCloud, which is the LibCloud, I guess, however you pronounce that, which is a virtualization management platform. Chris Moore is going to come in and talk about PCBSD, which is the version of FreeBSD that's been has features added to it, so it makes it really easy to install for desktop users. Jonathan Ellis, towards the end of Q3, is going to talk to us about Cassandra, which is the big data project, a data and data reduction project that originally was used to power Facebook and now has become an open source project. Lots and lots of people on the list, a lot of people still being added to the list. You can go to twitch.tv/floss and see the thing that's linked from there to get all your needs taken care of on that. Let's see, what else have I got to cover here? Also big news since last week. Some of you may have seen this already, but we now have both a Twitter and an Identica handle for Floss Weekly itself. So if you're tired of trying to piece through my tweets about whether you have what one I'm eating for lunch versus what's coming up on Floss Weekly, you can now just subscribe to one place, Floss Weekly, all one word, on either Identica or Twitter. And we also have a blog that's linked to those. So if you want to comment on any of our upcoming guests or comment on anything we're thinking about for the project, please go ahead and follow the links on Twitter or Identica, and you'll go right to the Postures blog for that, flossweekly.postures.com, if you want to just look it up directly. You can see me at FizzLay coming up in a few weeks. I'll be in Brazil. I got my 10-year visa from Brazil for about $600 it took. But I managed to get my visa, so I am, in fact, going to be there in Brazil, Porto Alegre, Brazil, in about 4 weeks from now. You can also see me at OSCON. I'm teaching a 3-hour Perl tutorial on Monday, and I'm going to be hanging around the rest of the week and, again, possibly doing a live show. Follow me on Twitter at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, if you want to find out more about where I'm going to be. And I'd be asking Simon at this point what he's doing, but apparently he's off the air. So this has just been the technically plagued show today. I'm so sorry, Simon. You don't get to say where you are going to be or will be, but we'll have to do it without you. So that's it. I got through without coughing too much today. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate KK coming on the show today and Simon for co-hosting in his absence. I'll just say thank you to him. And as always, we'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.